about our own bodies, about our own beings and how we function and what we adapt to and what our mechanisms are. We're very, very ignorant about all these things. But we need to have some idea of how these things work in order to help us make decisions about what we're going to do next and who we're going to believe and things like that. So we build narratives, we build stories. And the people who, for the establishment forces, for the bosses, the people who construct and maintain these narratives are the professional classes. And one of the most important of these professional classes is medicine. They construct narratives that are extremely powerful in terms of controlling you and keeping you in your place and making you believe that you have great benefit from being part of whatever structured society they want to propose for you. So that's the purpose of these professional classes, whether they're scientists or MDs and so on. And this fits into a picture of the world, which is the following one that I'm going to explain to you. A lot of people argue about political theories. How do societies organize? How could they organize? Why do they organize that way? And you have these competing political theories, everything from, you know, capitalism, socialism, all the way to anarchism, and people will argue about which one is better. But I'm going to cut through all that, and I'm going to say there's only one reality here. And that reality is the following. Social animals, any social animal, and this is goes from insects all the way to advanced mammals, including humans, social animals organize into dominance hierarchies, period. That is the organizing principle. You organize into what are known as dominance hierarchies. This has been studied extensively. All the animal behaviorists know this, and they know that it applies to humans as well. And if you look at societies throughout history, what you will always see is various societies organizing into dominance hierarchies. Call it a serfdom, call it a kingdom, call it a democracy, call it what you want. These are all dominance hierarchies. They're the same kinds of organizations that troops of monkeys organize into, or packs of wolves, or any kind of social animal will have a dominance hierarchy. And within that dominance hierarchy, there are dominant individuals who control access to resources, to breeding, to make the important decisions about what the group is going to do and so on, who they're going to attack next, and all this kind of thing. So there are dominant individuals, and then there's a whole bunch of classes of subservient individuals. And so this dominance hierarchy can be quite structured, can have a class structure, or it can be very extreme, where there's really just a couple that are completely dominant, and everyone else is subservient to a large extent, so kind of a serfdom. So humans, the human species is hardwired to organize this way. And one of the things, and it is advantageous for an animal society to organize as a dominance hierarchy, because you will have more success surviving against the elements and surviving against competing groups for resources and so on, if you are organized as an efficient dominance hierarchy. So it is evolutionarily preferred to have a dominance hierarchy. But that dominance hierarchy itself has to be stable, resilient, and so on. And human societies, which are large and complex, can change the structure of the dominance hierarchy. So the way that the classes are organized and how much of a class structure there is can vary from one society to the next and can vary historically. And what you will find is that in a human society, the class structure can evolve in time towards something that is what we call totalitarian, where there's very few people at the top and everyone else is at the bottom, more or less a serfdom or a slave society. That's an extreme towards you, which you can go. And a society like that is not as resilient generally, is not as stable, is not as competitive as a society that has more class structure, because those tend to be more robust because you're taking advantage of the creativity and the contributions of more of the individuals, and they tend to be stronger societies. But what happens is that the elite elements in the human society will change the rules of the game to their advantage. And if they do this, if they're allowed to do this too much, they'll go too far and they'll bring you towards a totalitarian system. So that's how you can understand what is going on in these societies. And there's a brilliant theoretical physics paper that was written about this recently, a couple years ago, by Joseph Hickey and his PhD supervisor at the time, does a theoretical model of the evolution and stability of dominance hierarchies. And they showed that there are two parameters that control the stability of a dominance hierarchy. And they are a parameter that represents how authoritarian society is. So in other words, when there are fights between groups or individuals in the society, does the person with the highest social status, will they basically always win, or will they sometimes lose that fight? If they always win, even if they have just a little bit more power or social status, then that is a very authoritarian society. The other parameter, the other control parameter, is how violent the society is. Meaning, when you lose such a battle, such a struggle, such a fight for influence, how big is the punishment? If the punishment is disproportionate, really large, you go to jail forever and so on, then that is a highly violent society. And so with just these two control parameters, they were able to show from first principles that a democracy will be stable for a long period of time. That means a class structure, a very detailed class structure and a robust hierarchy will be stable as long as those two parameters are in a domain of what we call the phase space, are not too large. So more of a fair society, not too authoritarian and not too violent. The punishment is proportionate to the breach in rules, for example. Okay. Then you will have a stable democracy for a long time. If you move out of that place in the phase diagram in terms of these two parameters, you may go into a region of the phase space where there is a rapid evolution from that democratic society rapidly towards a totalitarian state. That's what they showed. And so the authoritarian and violent nature of the society is basically our laws and rules. And the problem is these laws and rules in a good, stable, free-thinking society will constantly be adjusted so that you maintain this nice, stable democracy. The problem is when you start to have corruption, the elite elements will get you to pass laws that are to their advantage, but that are destabilizing to the society as a whole. And that's where you can get walking away from that nice place in the phase space of those two parameters towards approaching the edge where you might run away towards a totalitarian state. So it's always the corruption from the elite elements that can change the rules to their advantage. That's always the problem in terms of a society being destabilized towards a totalitarian state. So there's a beautiful theory of that that allows you to understand politics from a very high level. And my contribution to this has been the following. I argued that if we're going to stabilize dominance hierarchies, and get individuals to respect their place within that dominance hierarchy, that's not an easy thing to do, because generally individual animals want to have influence, more access to resources, they want to breed and so on. So there's this battle between maintaining the hierarchy and the individual wanting to express themselves. And you have to find a balance between those things. And that's in the human society, you set up rules so that you have a constant and robust democracy. But generally speaking, among all animal species, one of the things that is found is the following. Individual health is determined by the animal's position within that dominance hierarchy. In other words, an animal will be sick more often and more sick when they get sick and will die sooner if they're at the bottom of the hierarchy versus nearer the top. And the reason for that, in terms of the mechanism, is that a dominance hierarchy stress that the individual experiences suppresses their immune system. So this is another big truth that medicine doesn't tell you about, or doesn't tell you about very often, and that is the following. In terms of the health of the individual, the single biggest determinant is the stress experienced by that individual. Because that stress is very powerful at suppressing your immune system and your ability, therefore, to meet life's challenges, whether, you know, whatever they may be in terms of your body. So experienced stress comes from the aggressions within the dominance hierarchy to keep you in your place. And the kind of aggression, the kind of violence in a dominance hierarchy is generally random violence without rhyme or reason. So it should be random, chaotic violence just to keep you in your place. The most effective kind of violence to keep you in your place is something that doesn't make sense, that happens randomly, and where you think, well, I just have to obey. And so there are many studies that demonstrate this, and animals use it all the time. The dominance in a dominance hierarchy will often randomly aggress people just to keep them in animals, I mean, within that dominance hierarchy, to keep them in their place. And that's much more effective than if you only punish them for something they did wrong. So that means that you're, as an animal within a dominance hierarchy, you're going to be subjected to constant aggressions and stress. It can be the difficulty of getting something done before an administration, the difficulty of buying something that you need, the difficulty, whatever. You're going to be frustrated and subjected to these kinds of stresses. So there are two major categories of stress that have a really significant impact on your individual health. One is the stress that I've just been describing, the stress of being in a dominance hierarchy. The other category of stress is even more deadly because it acts more rapidly. The first category of stress, dominance hierarchy stress, is kind of a chronic stress. You're always being subjected to it. And wherever you are in that dominance hierarchy, that you're going to be sick more often, you're going to die younger if you're nearer to the bottom. All right, that's the chronic stress from the dominance hierarchy. There's another kind of important stress, and it's the following. It's the kind of stress where your life is changed dramatically all of a sudden. So you lose your sense of your place within the society. This can be caused by becoming disabled and therefore losing your job and not having the place that you always thought you would have within that hierarchy. So lose big losses in your life, life-changing events, loss of a partner, of a parent, of many family members, of your work, all these things and combinations of them, if they have an impact on you personally, where you feel that you lose the meaning of your life, then that is extraordinarily deadly. you will be dead within a short time. Okay. You'll get some, you'll develop some kind of very lethal cancer or something, but you're going to die. So that is the other kind of stress that changes your self-image. And that's very deadly. And you see people die from that all the time, dying from that all the time. And it's very difficult to be resilient against those kinds of big changes. So basically, in summary, experienced stress is the very first, most determinant thing in terms of your individual health. The second one, which researchers have found, is whether or not you're socially isolated. So they're kind of related. If you have a network and you're not, and you're socially connected, then your immune system is stronger and you're more resilient against attacks against your body. And that's really good for you. Those are the two main things. Otherwise, your body, your biology, your ability, the mind and the body and the organs, everything, your immune system is extremely powerful at resisting whatever infections or pathogens you might encounter or anything like that. And they don't generally tell you that. Medicine wants you to believe that by accident you might catch something, be infected with something, and therefore we need to come in and help you. Actually, the truth is you're living in an environment where those kinds of assaults against your body are constant. They're everywhere. They're all the time. And your body is extremely good at completely resisting those assaults and recovering. And it's remarkably good. So something like 99% of what might happen to you, your body will solve it. And the problem is that your body becomes less able to solve it because you're being subjected to intolerable or excess stress, or you're being subjected to these life changes that really change even your place in the world, your self-image, and so on. That's when the problem occurs, and medicine can do very little about these things. Now, I'll give you an example of, I'm going to kind of contradict myself now. I'm just following my chain of thought here. I'm going to contradict myself and say, here's how cancer treatment works. Okay. You, for whatever reason, are in a place in your life where you're susceptible to cancer. You've lost something dramatic. You've been suffering too long in a toxic work environment. You are now susceptible to getting cancer. There are going to be tumors in some of your vital organs, and they're detecting these with their detection methods, and they're diagnosing you as having developed cancer. And they're saying, we're going to help you with chemotherapy. Let's be clear, chemotherapy injected into your circulatory system is a lethal poison. It is horrible, horrible stuff. It's intended to kill cells. And it kills cells that reproduce more rapidly than cells that reproduce less rapidly. And tumor cells divide more rapidly. Tumors grow rapidly. So the logic is we're going to fill you with poison in the hope that we kill some of these cells we don't like more than all the other cells in your body. Okay? So that's why you lose your hair. Those are cells that divide quickly and so on. So we're going to poison you, okay? And if it's near the surface of your body, we can also point radiation at it. We're going to burn it, all right? And we're going to do what we can to save you. This is what they're telling you, all right? Now, here's a person that's already in a weakened state. Their metabolism is such that these tumors are growing. And now you're going to come in and assault the body even more. And how can that possibly help the person? Here's my answer. You're not only going to do these horrible things to them, but you're going to surround them with kind nurses and experts that are going to explain to them how important they are, that they're going to do everything they can to save your life. They're going to change your social circumstances completely. Nurses are going to be visiting your home. A whole team of experts is going to be concerned about you and your family. Your employer is going to say, please take as much time as you need from work. Your life is going to be completely turned around, and you're going to become the most important thing in the world with all these people buzzing around you trying to help you and everybody expressing sympathy towards you. So whereas before you were isolated, alone, feeling all of the effects of this stress, all of a sudden you're put into an environment, if you'll only accept these treatments, where it is a very caring environment. That is one mechanism, I would argue, that the so-called cancer treatments can help you. And then if you survive it and you get back on track, then you're convinced that the chemo and whatever they did to you is what saved you, and you're very, very thankful and so on, right? But objectively, if you do a scientific study, if you look for evidence that these treatments actually help, you won't find it. If you look at the randomized control trials to try and determine if these things help, they don't. If you, and I've studied this, I've looked at a lot of these things. If you do a randomized control trial, in fact, one of the things you'll find, for example, is if they're screening for more cancer and detecting them and treating them, they're actually killing people more. The more you screen, the more medicine gets in there and does harm. So there's a number of very lengthy studies that showed that breast cancer screening was detrimental to the society where they were having a policy like that. So I'm just trying to convey how big their lies are, what's really going on in terms of your body and society, and the fact that they can't even justify what they're doing. Scientifically. So that is kind of where I wanted to go with this. Let me just see if there's something here that I noted that I wanted to cover that I haven't yet. I'll just conclude this way. One of the tools that I have used to try to understand health is to look at what is called all-cause mortality. So I look at a society and I say, well, how many people are dying? And how many are dying in a given jurisdiction as a function of time, you know, per day or per week or per month, per year? And how old are they? And what sex are they? And so on. If you're looking at that kind of data, just the number of deaths, you're looking at all-cause mortality. And that is a very powerful technique because it cannot be corrupted. If you're actually counting deaths, you cannot fake it. You can't say, oh, but they died of this or that. No, no, no. There's no politics involved. There's no judgment. There's no clinical evaluation. The person's dead or they're not. And if they died, you count them. And so I look at hard data. And what I find when I look at hard data are things like the following. I look at, for example, all-cause mortality since the Second World War in Western countries, or all-cause mortality since 1900 in the United States. And what I find is that the only thing that can give you an increase in all-cause mortality is things like a war, a major war, where people are actually going to war and there are difficult times because of the war, a huge economic hardship like the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, that kind of thing in the United States, extremely unhealthy living conditions, like if you have a working class that is just totally exploited at the slave level kind of exploitation where they just don't care about workers, then they're not getting clean water, they're not having access to proper food, they don't have proper shelter, and life expectancies are very low in that group. So you can see all-cause mortality on a per capita basis come down as living conditions improve, as democracies are established and there's a more stratified social order and there's more protection for the most vulnerable, you can actually see a very regular drop in all-cause mortality, for example, since the Second World War. and so living conditions generally. Those are the kinds of things that can produce measurable changes in all-cause mortality. So none of the so-called pandemics that were declared by the CDC can be detected in all-cause mortality. There have been 5 modern pandemics, and they estimate how many people would have died. And then you go and look for those deaths in the all-cause mortality. You will not find them. I tried. Okay? So that gives you the idea that these pandemics are maybe something fabricated. What I have demonstrated regarding COVID is that all the deaths, all the excess all-cause mortality is correlated to what the assaults against people, what they actually did against people in terms of increasing stress, social isolation, and also these horrendous protocols that they implemented at the beginning in hospitals and so on, gives a peak in all-cause mortality, which comes on exactly when they start applying those protocols. So I have analyzed this in detail in approximately 30 articles, looking at all-cause mortality in various countries and so on. And I have demonstrated that this is incompatible with the idea of a spreading respiratory disease and is instead highly correlated to poverty and to the size of the pools of very vulnerable people. For example, the 13 million people in the United States who are officially recognized as being disabled by a mental illness. So when you have large pools of these kinds of people and you assault them in the way that we did, many of them will die. So that was another big lie, and it can be explained naturally in terms of the assaults that were perpetrated against people. And that